91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we visit with scholar and historian Dr. Marvin Dunn. For many years he headed the Florida International University's Psychology Department. He's a prolific author, columnist, and filmmaker. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Dr. Dunn's latest book is A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. It documents Africans wading ashore with Ponce de Leon, recalls their slavery during the American colonial period, and how many blacks fought for freedom on the side of the Seminoles, then endured decades of intimidation, lynchings, and virulent discrimination. The native Floridian, Dr. Marvin Dunn, witnessed decades of Jim Crow and then wrote about Black Miami in the 20th century. Stay tuned for our discussion of his latest book after NPR and regional news. And we return with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. As you may well know, whenever possible, we celebrate Florida history on our program. And today we have with us an authority, historian, professor, and scholar, Dr. Marvin Dunn.
A native Floridian, his own upbringing from blatant Jim Crow times to a celebrated tenure as per university department head and author, is nearly as remarkable as the history he writes so eloquently about.
Dr. Dunn's nonfiction works include A History of Black Miami in the 20th Century and A Study of Anti-Black Violence in Florida. He's also written the definitive book about the landmark and tragic Miami riots of 1980.
He now has a new work. It's A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. So we want to welcome you, Dr. Marvin Dunn. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin today with your statement about this book. Would you kindly read it for us?
The top one. Awesome. I know Florida. I was born in Florida during the reign of Jim Crow and have lived to see black astronauts blasted into the heavens from Cape Canaveral. For 3/4 of a century, I have lived mostly in Florida. I have seen her flowers and her warts. This book is about both. People of African descent have been in Florida from the arrival of Ponce de Leon in 1513. Yet our presence in the state is virtually hidden. A casual glance at most Florida history books depict African Americans primarily as laborers, who are shown as backdrops to white history. The history of blacks in Florida has been deliberately distorted, omitted, and marginalized. We have been denied our heroes and heroines. Our stories have been mainly left untold. This book lifts the veil from some of those stories and places African Americans in the very marrow of Florida history.
Thank you. From reading that.
You're welcome.
How painful was it, or is it still, for you to uncover these buried facts and truths?
It was very painful. I spent a lot of time in graveyards, cemeteries. I stood over the graves of a lot of people who had been lynched, murdered, and forgotten. The most memorable of which was the 15-year-old boy named Willie James Howard, who was lynched in Live Oak, Florida in 1944. This was about 10 years before Emmett Till in Mississippi, a case that made national, if not international, news. But almost the exact same thing happened to this boy in Live Oak, and hardly a peep about it. So the difficult part for me was going back to the graves, and in a sense, walking the ground where some of these terrible things have happened. I mean, I went to Rosewood 20 years ago. I've been going back. Just got back last night from Rosewood. Ocoee, where a tremendous event took place in 1920 over voting. Newberry, 1916, the largest lynching in Florida history, where they killed 8 people in the course of 2 days. And then totally almost forgotten about. So a lot of the book deals with that part of Florida history. But it also deals with a much larger scope. The book begins with the arrival of blacks with Ponce de Leon in 1513.
And we go 100 years before Jamestown.
That's right, exactly, exactly. There were free black people living in Florida when English people landed at Jamestown. So I wanted to cover the colonial era and how blacks fared during that time. And then the territorial period when Florida became a territory, then a state, and it got very rough for blacks once the Americans took over the state. I wanted to discuss the role that blacks had with Seminole Indians and how that all fared through history. And then, of course, the Civil War and Reconstruction. So the book goes back and covers this whole span of history.
I wish we had about 3 hours.
We don't. I should be quiet. Right? Yeah, ask some questions. But anyway, just to finish the scope of the book, a large section does deal with lynchings and anti-black violence.
There's a table in the back of about 12 pages or so, year by year, of the lynchings in Florida every year. And in one year, I think 1923, there were 11 that were recorded, 11 lynchings in the state.
Oh. Yes, actually, compared, Florida had, in terms of the per capita, the number of black people living in the state, Florida's lynching rate was worse than Mississippi.
So what do you attribute that? Why was there so much violence in Florida more than the other southern states?
Because you had in Mississippi, in Georgia, in South Carolina, enslaved black people who were accustomed to the whip, the oppression of slavery. Mm-hmm. But in Florida, you had a lot of escaped slaves who were living free in Florida, who were armed and hostile. You had them in alliance with Indians, very dangerous to white settlement. So there was a lot more. And you also had blacks who were Maroons, who were the descendants of black people who came in with the Spanish, who escaped and set up their own communities, Maroon communities. And these people never lived as slaves. So there was a lot more resistance to the oppression of blacks in Florida. From the very, very beginning because of the factors I just mentioned.
One thing I wanted to bring up, because Andrew Jackson is so commonly discussed these days about whether he should remain on the $20 bill or not. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in your book you relate to his rather sad actions. He really made his name in Florida, and there That's was right. genocide involved. Explain a little bit why people are so upset with Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson was a racist. He was the second worst president we've ever had in this country. He became famous because of his determination to rid most of the country that was not settled, to rid the country of Indians and hostile blacks. And he went about this even contrary to national law.
You mean blacks that weren't slaves?
Correct.
Of course.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. So Jackson comes into Florida when Florida was under the control of the Spanish, totally against the law, and starts rounding up people and sending them back to their chains in Georgia and South Carolina and other places, and then was particularly violent in his attack on what was called the Negro Fort. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that, but some black slaves had managed to, with the help of the British, establish a black a fort for Negroes, for slaves who escaped in the Panhandle area, living peaceably on the Apalachicola River. And around 1814 or so, Jackson sent gunboats up that river and blasted these people to death, killed over 300 women and children, just to have this fort that was manned by blacks, never fired on anybody, not overlooking the Apalachicola River. So Jackson directed a lot of activities against blacks and against Indians and became a very popular candidate for president, much like the populism we see today in the current president. Rode in on the wave of the people want me, I'm doing what they want, particularly in terms of removing hostiles from the continent.
And, of course, went on to be the first territorial governor of Florida.
And Jacksonville was named after him. Jackson High School here in Miami-Dade, there's a statue of Jackson. When you go into the quadrangle at Jackson High School, and I was out there a year or so ago, and I asked some of the kids, do you know who this guy was? No. Sit down. Let me tell you who Andrew Jackson was. And they're just shocked to see that this, you know, to know the history of this man.
I was surprised when I read about the treatment of the Spanish black slaves when they arrived here. Would you talk about that a little? Because that was really interesting to me, how they were treated versus the African black slaves.
Well, even under the Spanish, it was still slavery. So one was not free, but right. relative to English imposed slavery, Spanish imposed slavery was much more lenient. For example, Spanish slaves could become free by fighting for the government, by taking up arms against the enemies of the crown. They could become free merely by reverting to Catholicism. So if you were a slave in Georgia and you managed to escape into Spanish Florida and converted to Catholicism, you were a free person. So you had options for protection under Spanish law. For example, Spanish slaves had a right to sue a cruel master. And other kinds of things that just were not carried over into English slavery. Now, when American slavery took hold, none of those things were applied. And for the first time in the history of slavery in the whole world, slaves became chattel property right. rather than human beings who, by circumstance, were enslaved. They were now defined as property. And that had to happen in this country because if they were to be recognized as human beings, then they would have had to have been accorded the freedoms that were guaranteed in the Constitution.
Dr. Dunn, moving ahead a little bit, I hate to get back to murders and lynchings and things, but mm-hmm. it's such a remarkable force in the state. But tell us a little bit about the 1951 murder of Harry T. Moore. Mm. And that was just about the time that you, as a young boy, 10-year-old, were moving to Miami from DeLand.
Yeah.
A lot of people aren't aware of Moore.
Harry T. Moore, as I said in the book, was arguably the most courageous man next to Osceola who ever walked in Florida. He was an educator who was the principal of a black school in Brevard County, and his wife was also a teacher. And in his spare time, he traveled around the state organizing chapters of the NAACP in rural areas of the state of Florida. And as he began to do that in the 1930s and 40s, he attracted a lot of attention from white people who were afraid that by the organizing blacks, particularly politically, that they would have a seat at the table in terms of political power in Florida. So Harry T. Moore was doing things that attracted a lot of attention. He was criticizing white sheriffs for lynchings, for being a part of or covering up lynchings. He went after Willis V. McCall, the notorious sheriff of Lake County, Florida's Bull Connor. Harry T. Moore took him on directly. He wrote to the NAACP in Washington. He wrote to newspapers all over the country. And then Christmas night, 1951, his wife and he were celebrating their anniversary, and the KKK placed the bomb beneath the house, the bedroom, exploded. His body was thrown up into the ceiling. Friends later said it seemed that every bone in his body was broken. They put him in a car with his mother, who was visiting from Jacksonville, I think, and then rushed him over to Sanford, to the only hospital that would accept blacks at that time. This was 1951, and he died on the way. As they crossed the St. John River, he passed. And that was the end of Harry T. Moore. They never found out who did it. Eventually, the house where this happened and the orange grove that was a part of the property has been made a park by the county of Brevard County. But the mystery was never solved, and Harry T. Moore was the first real martyr of the modern civil rights movement.
Well, unfortunately, tragically, you needed to devote three full chapters to just the lynchings, not to mention all the killings, and we're going to get back to more of them. We're speaking with Dr. Marvin Dunn. He's an historian, scholar, organizer, and former FIU professor of psychology. His latest book is A History of Florida Through Black Eyes.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Marvin Dunn, historian and psychology professor. We're talking about his latest book. He's written numerous books on Florida history, but the latest one is A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. Dr. Dunn, you wanted us to make a distinction between lynching and murder, both terrible distinctions.
But there's a difference. For a killing to qualify as a lynching, and this was agreed to back in the 1930s by people who were concerned about lynching at that time, the agreement was that There had to be first a body, the person had been actually killed. The killing had to be extra legal, outside of the law. It had to have been done by three or more people. And finally, the motive must have been race or vengeance. Those four things distinguish a lynching from a common murder.
And not necessarily a rope.
Actually, there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. You don't need a rope for an act of killing to be qualified as a lynching. In fact, most of the blacks who were lynched in Florida were shot. Many were beaten to death or drowned. One reason why ropes were difficult to use in lynchings was because the folks that did it didn't know how to tie a lynching knot. It's not an easy thing to tie a hangman's knot. So rather than having a bad lynching, which by definition at the time would be one in which the person strangled to death and dangled around and took an hour to die, versus breaking the person's neck. So they would come up with these innovative ways of tying the person to a small tree, bending the tree over, putting a rope around the person's neck, and then letting the tree go, and it would snap and break the person's neck. So they found innovative ways to kill people without necessarily resorting to a lynching rope.
And the other aspect of lynching is that many of the black victims of lynching were sexually mutilated. Would you explain why?
You know, there were lynchings of white people in Florida. Not many, but occasionally there were white men who were lynched in Florida and other states as well. But I'd never found one instance in which a white man was castrated, made to consume his genitals, as Claude Neal was in 1934 in Marianna. No instance of a white male being treated in this way. This was something reserved for black men and boys who were suspected of, accused of inappropriate sexual actions with a white woman. I tried to bring psychology to that. I mean, how is it that the genitals of white men don't get attacked, but those of black men do? Mm-hmm. And I've come to the view that a lot of this goes back to slavery and sexual myths about slaves and about black males and about black females, for that matter, and the view that black males were more prolific and more sexually capable and what have you. And I think over the years, there developed a kind of a sexual jealousy from many southern white males in particular about black men sexually. And I think part of the explanation for the aggressive mutilation of black men relates to those paranoid sexual stereotypes that many southern men carried, and some even today, I think, may still possess those feelings. And I think also it applies to not just white men in the South, but I think there are some etchings of this throughout our society, just unresolved sexual issues and conflicts between the races.
I'd like to go to Newberry, Florida, in what came to be known as Lynch Hammock because of the number of lynchings that took place there. And I believe the earliest you talked about were these two 12-year-old boys who were harvesting, picking watermelons.
Mm-hmm. 1902.
1902. That 1902, right. Mm-hmm. And they were 12 years old, mm-hmm. and they were accused of eating the hearts out of the watermelon.
That's right.
So they took them and they lynched them.
They lynched both of them. Yeah, the youngest lynchings that I found were those two in Newberry. Newberry is directly west of Gainesville on Highway 26. And as you come into Newberry from Gainesville, you pass right through Lynch Hammock.
And it's still called that?
Still called that, even though there's a housing development in there. White folks have kind of some duplexes in there. But most of it is still heavily wooded, these enormous oak trees. And that's where they would take blacks in that area to lynch. And in 1916, they lynched, they killed eight people, and five of them were lynched on one tree in Lynch Hammock, including a woman, Stella Young was her name. She was heavily pregnant when they lynched her. The baby dropped when she was lynched. A white woman there caught the baby and saved it. I met the man, grown man.
Who was the baby?
Yes, exactly, who was raised by a relative. And the woman who now owns that property, part that is now primarily in Lynch Hammock, is a black woman who runs a funeral home. And she allowed me to walk the property with her. And she said, you know, they say that when Stella was lynched, and that baby dropped, that the moon came out like sunlight, and it scared the white people, and they ran away. And I think a lot of the guilt about having lynched that woman in Newberry is still present in that community. I found a photograph of the bodies of these victims.
Yeah.
In the Duval County Public Library, the basement of the library, this man brought me this picture 30 years ago. I didn't know where it was taken, who these people were, but found out over the years that it was from Newberry. But what they did with these bodies is they had them stacked like you would see cords of wood, but they hid Stella underneath the men. So you would have to really go, and I took you can zoom in on the photograph,
right.
And I saw her face, like she was sleeping. So they tried to cover up, even in the celebration of the lynchings.
They were still ashamed of that.
That they'd killed a woman.
When you say you met the baby who mm-hmm. fell out of the tree, who's mm-hmm. obviously a grown man now, mm-hmm. he was raised by a white family?
No, a black lady. The white lady saved him and then gave him to a relative of...
Okay.
And that lady raised him.
And what was the name of that family that carried out all these killings? I can't remember.
The Dudleys.
The Dudleys.
Gosh, don't start me on the Dudleys.
Yeah.
you did start me on the Dudleys, so I'll try to be brief
about
that.
Yeah, talk about the Dudleys.
The Dudley family was a very early pioneering family, white family, in the Gainesville area, Alachua County. They brought slaves in from South Carolina, had a large plantation, a lot of blacks working on that plantation. And then when slavery came, a lot of the black people simply stayed and were sharecroppers. When this killing happened, it really got started because of the fact that a black man killed a white constable whose sister was a Dudley, was the matriarch of the Dudley family. All this land, all these contacts that the Dudley family had, this black man did in fact shoot and kill this white constable, this man who was related to Fanny Dudley. And Fanny had four sons and a lot of daughters. And basically what happened was they tied the ropes for this lynching at the Dudley farm in the kitchen. I've been in that kitchen where these ropes were tied. And then her four sons went out with the rest of the mob and committed these murders. And the youngest son, Frank Dudley, who was 16 at the time, had the nerve years later to tell exactly what happened. He was there. He described how these people were lynched. So the Dudleys were in it up to their nose hairs. And yet, all of that is hidden in Newberry. You wouldn't know that this happened. And ironically, the Dudley Farm is now a state park, sort of like Williamsburg, made over to look like it was back in the day when it was a cracker farm. But that's where one of the most horrendous acts of anti-black violence took place, in Newberry on that Dudley Farm.
There's one more. Did you want to say something, Jim?
We were talking about Gainesville quite a bit in the history of that. Some of our listeners probably aren't aware of the origin of the name Gainesville. Tell us more about Edmund Gaines and how he related to Andrew Jackson.
Gaines was a general who came into Florida during the Seminole Wars after the military had failed miserably to try to get rid of the Indians, and was trying to track them down out in the Everglades all throughout the state and having trouble trying to catch them and their black allies who were fighting with them. But Gaines came in and took the view that stop chasing the men. Arrest the women and children, and the men will come in. And that's what happened. That's how they got most of the Seminole men to agree to come in, to be removed to the west, to reservations in Oklahoma primarily, and out of the way of white settlement. And then Gainesville was named after him, but that was basically his legacy in Florida.
Let's take a short break on our program. We'll come back with Dr. Marvin Dunn right after this.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're with Dr. Marvin Dunn, historian, scholar, organizer, and...
Filmmaker,
former head of the Department of Psychology at FIU. While we're in this realm, I thought we'd talk about Rosewood, Florida. You said you were there last night. Mm-hmm. Many of us know about the tragic events and the stain that still remains from that massacre. But for those who don't, can you explain what happened in January of 1923?
Oh, yes. A white woman named Fanny Taylor lived in a town about 2 miles west of Rosewood. Rosewood is about due west of Gainesville, about 9 miles before you hit the Gulf of Mexico. You pass through Rosewood. And this white woman accused a black man of having attacked her. when in fact the woman who was married was entertaining her white boyfriend. They got it while her husband was at work. They got into some sort of altercation, and he in some way battered her. And this woman had to have some explanation for her husband as to why she was battered while he was at work. And it was very common in those days for white women to accuse black men of assaulting them when they needed an excuse to explain something else that was going on. So this woman made that accusation. She didn't say that he raped her. She simply said he attacked her. And now comes into Rosewood all these people, many of them from Perry, Florida, close by. But even outside of the state, people flocked in to try to find this man who committed this alleged crime. It turns out they tracked the alleged assailant to Rosewood. A mob assembled there to try to capture him. They attacked a house belonging to the Carrier family, which is the most prominent black family in Rosewood at the time. Several family members were ensconced in the house at the time of this attack. Mrs. Carrier, the black woman who was at the house when this happened, the Taylor house when this happened, who knew this woman had a white boyfriend, but didn't tell the sheriff when she was asked what happened. But she went back to Rosewood and told the black folks, this woman had a boyfriend in there. He beat her up. Now they're looking for a black man, and there's no such person involved. In any case, the Carrier stood up to this mob. They had other Masons, primarily men who were Masons, in the woods around the house, helping to protect the Carrier family. In effect, what happened was that Mrs. Carrier was killed, first person to be killed, shot through the head. Her son, Sylvester Carrier, who was a World War I veteran, independent, uppity black in those days, they would call him that. He was also killed, and he killed two white men on his front porch who were trying to get into the house. And then the town was burned to the ground. All the black people left. Now, this was in January. It was very, very cold. You had children out in the woods, in the swamp, in their nightclothes for 2 or 3 days trying to escape the mob coming in, burning the town down. Some people were saved, but all of the black people left, and their land was taken over by white people for taxes. No black people live in Rosewood today.
Except for your land.
I have a partner, a white partner, and he and I purchased 5 acres of land.
Why?
Because I saw how the development of Rosewood was going. People were buying up the properties and building houses. White people were. And I wanted to have one part of Rosewood that stayed the way it was in 1923. So I found these 5 acres that included a part of the railroad track that came through, operated between Gainesville and Cedar Key. And that railroad, a train was used to come into Rosewood and take women and children out to safety in Gainesville. So I wanted to have a part of that scene maintained and preserved for history. So we bought this land because it contains a big strip of the old railroad track, just as it was. The rails are gone, but the rail bed is like a green tunnel right through the woods. So that's why we have that property there.
So maybe someday something to commemorate might be erected there?
Well, in terms of the history of the community, the property that we have is not that important. What is important, though, is the old Masonic Lodge property, which we're now trying to work towards some acquisition of that property for history. I made some progress just the other day of discussing some possibilities for preserving that.
What kind of town is it today? I mean, it's all white.
Don't blink. The biggest building on the highway is the First Baptist Church. And then that's it. There's really nothing there. The home of J.W. Wright, the white man who did the right thing, who saved people, hid people in his house during this event, his house was left standing, and it's right on Highway 24. That's really about it. There's just nothing there.
There's a marker that's very easy to miss,
The marker is there, right. But the homes are off the highway in these five-acre plots, so you really couldn't tell how much settlement is there unless you actually got out and off the main road and drove down through the community.
Dr. Marvin Dunn, I'd like to spend some time talking about you and your life. You were born in DeLand around 1940.
Yeah.
And tell us a thumbnail of your story and how you came to be.
and your experiences with Jim Crow, your direct experiences with Jim Crow.
Some of the stories in the book you tell are really incredible.
Well, I my dad was a migrant worker. We went up on the migrant season when I was a boy, from the time I was about 8 or 9. We came out of that migrant stream. My dad was able to save a little money and move us to Miami in 1951 and buy a home. And we became part of the blue collar, I guess, class in that respect. I knew Jim. I was always tempted to drink from the white fountain, water fountain, but I never did. They had them in the Volusia County Courthouse when I was a boy. And if black people had to go down around the back of the courthouse to go to the bathroom, I found all that to be strange. My grandmother kept her money in a mayonnaise jar buried under the house because black people couldn't open bank accounts. You could keep your money in the post office, but you couldn't open a bank account. So all these things were very much a part of what I saw growing up. But by the time we moved to Miami in 1957, I got admitted to college. I was 16. Got admitted early to college, and I guess I'll tell this one story because it does indicate the times. September 1957, my mom and dad took me downtown to the Greyhound bus station downtown Miami, and my mom and my grandmother took me to the back seat of that Greyhound bus and said, "Now, honey, you stay here until you get to Atlanta tomorrow." It was a Sunday night, and they gave me a little brown bag with a couple of sandwiches in it. A knee-high soda, and say, "Honey, you stay right here now. Don't you move out this seat." And they got off. And then my dad got on the bus. And my dad was a longshoreman. My mom and my grandmother were sanctified women, but my dad was not sanctified. And he says to me, "Now listen, he used the N-word a lot. So listen to you little N-word. You keep your little such-and-such on this back seat until your such-and-such gets to Atlanta tomorrow. Don't you move. You hear me?" And then he got off. So the bus takes off. It's late at night. And I stayed on the back seat until we got to Fort Lauderdale. And then I moved up to the middle of the bus to ride the rest of the way to Atlanta. I wasn't crazy. I didn't move to the front, but I moved to the middle of the bus.
Push the envelope.
Rode, and the next morning, the bus was in Waycross, Georgia. And the Greyhound bus was being used as a school bus by some white kids, high school kids. And they get on the bus and they're talking. And by this time, there were white people sitting behind me who got nonsense during the course of the night. And one of these little white girls sat right next to me. I had never been that close to a white person. And the bus got quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And all of a sudden, somebody behind me said, "Nigga, get up. Move back where you belong." And other people started sort of chiming into that. And a white Marine in uniform, a corporal, stood up and said, "Why are you all bothering him? He's not bothering anybody. Why are you all?" And as soon as he spoke, they forgot about me. "Oh, you must be a nigger lover. You must be from the North. You must be a Jew." So the bus driver pulls the bus. We're outside of Waycross now, out in the country. And he pulls the bus over, and he walks back, and he says to me, he points at me, and says, "You are creating a disturbance on this bus. I'm putting you off." So he gave me my little cardboard suitcase and left me at a service station on that highway, and the bus went on to Atlanta. And the next bus came by about 3 hours later, and I got on it and rode the rest of the way to Atlanta.
Where did you sit on the bus?
On the very back seat.
And
I never told my parents what happened.
I have two questions. One is just something that for our listeners who are on the younger side, they don't know what we're talking about, maybe, with sitting in the back of the bus. Would you explain that?
Oh, well, during the Jim Crow period, you had to sit on the back of the bus if you were black. And if white people got on and the white seats filled up, then you had to get up and give your seat to a white person. It was just accepted as the way things happened. When it was all over and I would get onto a bus, I would sort of still see the imprint of the sign that they had up that said white seat from front, colored seat from rear. But that's the way Jim Crow was. You just had to abide by that, or you ran the risk of creating the kind of disturbance that I did on that bus to Atlanta.
And the question I had was if you're still scarred by these kind of events. When you talk about them, do they still...
Yes. Yes. I think every black person who has ever been insulted or frightened, genuinely frightened, or humiliated in the course of his or her life, remembers it. You don't forget that. It's the kind of an event that you just never forget it. You may not be wounded and carrying it around, but you never forget the day somebody called you a bad name, or the day someone treated you in that kind of a way. Just last year, I was at a resort in Broward County, very nice place, and I was going upstairs to get onto an elevator, and I got on, and there was a white woman with a little child getting on the elevator too, and the child stepped on to the elevator with me, and the mother pulled him back to wait for the next elevator, rather than the two of them getting on an elevator to go upstairs with me.
Doesn't end.
You remember it, the pain stays.
I wanted you to tell the story when you were in the military in the Navy, and the recruit from Louisiana.
Oh, that little boy. Well, the Navy had very few black officers in 1962, and I was had been given shore duty. Most of my time was spent on aircraft carriers, but I had shore duty in Great Lakes, Illinois, where recruits were taken in. And I was a battalion commander, which meant that I had about 14 companies of about 100 or so men in a company under my responsibility, and the petty officers in charge of taking care of these companies. In any case, one night in the wintertime, very, very cold, stormy night, I was going through the barracks during my inspection, and we walked through one barracks, and as we were about to go out the door, I heard somebody say, "It's a nigger." So I stopped and said to the company commander, "Whoever said that, I want him downstairs in my office when I finish doing these other companies." And sure enough, I get downstairs. There's this pole bean, skinny little white kid standing there, straight up, attention. Oh, and I told the company commander, "Bring all of his gear down here too." It was snowing. Bring all of his stuff, and then put a bunk for him out in the front yard, so he can wait for the shore patrol to come and get him. He can't sleep in my barracks. Get him out of here. Get his stuff. Get his bed. Get him out of here. So he comes down. He's standing up there. I said, "Why?" I asked him, "Why did you say that?" And without hesitation, said, "That's what we call him down in Louisiana, sir." "So you're not in Louisiana now, young man. You're in my battalion. And get out there and get in your bed and wait for the shore patrol to come." And he goes out and gets in bed. I knew they would be there in 5 or 10 minutes. I knew that. But he's all covered up in his bunk. And that must have been 1,200 little heads bobbing in the dark, looking down at this guy. "You don't mess with Lieutenant Dunn, man. You don't mess with him." Anyway, that one incident I just happened to remember.
I wanted you to tell that story because it was...
Yeah. Well, we have lots more little time left to speak to Dr. Marvin Dunn about his latest book, A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're having a conversation with Dr. Marvin Dunn. He's written a new book called A History of Florida Through Black Eyes, and we're reminiscing about his life and also the struggle for civil rights, especially in South Florida. Dr. Dunn, give us a little bit of a thumbnail of, say, starting post-World War II, of the efforts and some of the real giants and landmark events in the civil rights movement at that time.
Well, you would have to mention Father Theodore Gibson, the minister in Coconut Grove, who was very active as head of the local chapter of the NAACP. Dr. John Brown, who was an ophthalmologist, very active also in CORE, the other civil rights organization. These were folks who were doing things back in the 1940s before there was a national movement of any mention. And one of the things that galvanized...
Long before Selma.
Oh, yes. Right. Yes, indeed. And one of the things that galvanized these people was Virginia Key. When the military came in at the beginning of the Second World War, they needed a lot of military action. Bases were here. Black sailors were not allowed to be taught to swim at Crandon Park. The Navy taught white sailors to swim at Crandon Park, but they couldn't take black sailors out there. So the county allowed the Navy to use Virginia Key to train black sailors. The war is over, and the county takes the property back, and blacks go to the county and say, "Well, you know, we want that to be a Negro beach." They weren't asking to go to the white beach. They wanted to have their own colored beach. The county said no. So within weeks, if not days, Gibson and others led a wade-in at Hallover Beach, which is a county-owned beach in the North Dade area. And within 2 weeks of that wade-in, the county commission agreed to allow Virginia Key to be a Negro beach. And that's how we got that beach. A lot of actions by veterans who were coming in from the Second World War who were simply saying, we're not going to live the way that we did before the war. We want equal rights. And they led a lot of these activities.
You know, you just tell the story that you were in a hotel last week, in a resort last week, in the situation with the white woman pulling her baby out of the elevator and waiting for the next elevator because you were in it. Do you think that race is still a big... That racism is still as alive and well as it was during these years we're talking about? Do you think it's improved?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
One has to get perspective. I've heard people say, well, you know, nothing's changed. A lot has changed.
A lot has changed.
I mean, we've had black police chiefs in this town. That's significant.
Florida voted for a black man twice.
That's correct. But I think young people, particularly who don't have the historical perspective, might think that nothing's changed. In a sense, they're right about one thing that hasn't changed very much, and we've got to solve that problem. And that's the relationship between young blacks and the police and violence that comes from...
And poverty.
Yes. So we've never been able to crack that 27 to 30% of the black population that remains mired in poverty, no matter who's in the White House. So those things do have to be addressed. But the view that it's just as bad or not, the changes are not significant since the 1960s, just not true. Particularly, and I'll just end with this point, if you look at just black employment, especially in the public sector, the county, the state, the federal government, the cities, blacks are, in a sense, represented within reason of their numbers in the county. So overall, yes, progress has been made, but race is still an issue. And in this current atmosphere, it has become a major issue. I'm surprised, to tell you the truth, that we're back here on this issue in as serious a way as we are now.
Dr. Dunn, you wrote the book, and you're the authority on the 1980 Miami riots. Could that happen again?
Highly unlikely. That an event like that would happen again. For one thing, the makeup of the black community today is much more multi-ethnic than it was in 1980. You have many more blacks here from Haiti, the Caribbean, who don't have the same kind of emotional, historical baggage that African Americans do, and propels a lot of the violence that we see in race riots. Also, I think we are not likely to have that kind of event because you had to have had a major catastrophic breakdown in the law, in the legal system, in the justice system, for people to be that angry. To find another instance in American history when black people set out intentionally to kill white people in the streets, you have to go back to the Nat Turner Rebellion, back before slavery ended. Just highly, highly unusual that that amount of anger could be balled up into a shorter period of time, such as we saw in 1979 and the early part of 1980, so that explosion would be likely. The other reason I think is less likely is, think for a moment, suppose the so-called McDuffie jury that tried the white man who killed this man, suppose that jury of six white men had been a jury of three black people and three white people, and they found these officers not guilty. That would have been outrage, of course, but I don't think there would have been this sense of injustice, such as people,
and the idea that the trial was moved to Tampa to give a fair trial wound up being even probably would have been a better trial had it stayed in Miami-Dade County.
Well, there had been a very similar incident in Tampa as what had happened to McDuffie in Miami, and the trial still went to Tampa. Yeah.
But you were saying before the show that there's still no. This was 38th and Miami Avenue, or North Miami Avenue, and there's still no landmark, there's still no marker that William McDuffie was killed there.
I think that riot was probably the second most significant event in Miami history up to 1980, the 1926 hurricane perhaps being even more so, but that riot changed Miami, changed our perception. Our perception of ourselves changed the world's perception of us, and there's no physical reminder that this happened. And just because it was an ugly event and was a terrible thing does not mean you don't mark it historically.
Well, perhaps something could be done about that.
I hope so.
The end of your book ends. Your book ends with these words: "Let us learn from mistakes of the past and move on. After all, the challenge our country and the world face today leaves no room for racial, ethnic, or religious divisions." You wrote those words last year. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that today?
The same. I never accepted that most white people in this country were racist, even back in the worst of it. Racist in the sense that would actively do harm to black people, would actually go out and kill a black person. I don't think today that most white people are necessarily racist, although I think there's a lot of racial fear and animosity. But if you look at the fact of the history of the Klan and other extremist groups, they never attracted the bulk of the white mm-hmm. population. They were always on the fringes. Most people, I think, tend to be fair, but I think today especially are more confused about race than ever.
Are you troubled by what you see the last month or so?
Yes.
Last couple of months?
Yeah. I am genuinely frightened about what I see and hear. I won't go into a lot of the details about that, but it's a time when our country is facing the real possibility of a divide that will take decades to mend if we don't address it early and address it well.
Now that you've retired from being the head of the psychology department at FIU, it seems like you are finding more time to write and research. That must be very pleasing to you.
Well, I can get in my car and go any place I want to and follow up any story I wish to. And that's a great relief. And I think back on all those 35 years at FIU, all those meetings I went to. I'll tell you, all the meetings I went to in 35 years could have been done in one day. But when you're doing them, you don't realize that. But the great freedom of being retired and being able to do those things is just wonderful.
Tell us briefly about Roots in the City and where people can learn more about it.
Well, Roots in the City doesn't exist anymore, but my daughter took over my interest in gardening in inner city land and now has an organization called Health in the Hood.
Health in the Hood.
Health in the Hood.
Is there
online.
A website?
Mm-hmm, yep. And she now has gardens all over Broward, not all over, but several gardens in Dade and Broward County. But I got out of that hot sun.
So it's healthinthehood.com? Mm-hmm. We'll find it.
Health in the Hood will pop up. She's going to kill me. She's probably listening. Dad, you didn't know to tell them how to find Health in the Hood.
We'll have it on our website, I can promise. Yeah,
oh, good.
Dr. Marvin Dunn, historian, scholar, organizer, former FIU, head of the psychology department, his latest and author. His latest book is A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. We thank you so much for being with us.
Indeed,
thank
Dr.
you.
Dunn, thank
the book's
you.
On Amazon, incidentally.
Okay.
Okay.
Amazon.
And that wraps up today's program. We hope you enjoyed it. Apologies to those callers who were on our board. Our lead producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from Michael Stock, social media production from Jason Zabka, and Polly Landis is associate producer. The name of Dr. Dunn's book again, A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. And we have free audio archives of our program at WLRN.org. That's our website. More information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And you can hear us on our iTunes podcast. And tomorrow's program begins with a look at how cold weather snaps may affect subtropical plant and animal species. Especially affected are the non-native species. Some of those are applauded by experts. Also tomorrow, Linda Gastenheimer with acclaimed chef and restaurant guru Michael Schwartz. He may change some of your Super Bowl party ideas. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.